Okay, at this time we begin the TechNet. K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, that's Mel. And Kilowatt 2 Romeo India Whiskey, that's Dick. Run this thing called the TechNet. This is the beginning of TechNet number 1230. Believe it or not, starting way back in 1982 in September. We used to think that the TechNet would last for a couple of months. We'd answer people's questions and dry up and go away. And here we are, something like 26 years later. There's always a new crop of guys coming in. There's new kinds of ham radio continuously being invented. And you haven't seen nothing yet. Just wait till digital television really gets rolling. And there are a couple of very progressive amateur radio operators who are starting to experiment with digital television techniques, amateur radio, fast scan digital television techniques. So, what is the TechNet? It's a gathering of the clan. Smart people come together and help each other. There's an awful lot to learn about radio, antennas, transmission lines, propagation, and whatever. I'm always amazed when I have one of my little sessions where I give a puzzle to guys who have been working on antennas as an occupation for 20 years. And you ask them basic questions as to what goes on inside of a simple dipole. And the books don't cover that subject very well. You don't get direct answers. Well, by way of this TechNet, you'll get slightly more direct answers. You get hands-on experience from people like Mel and Dick and Alex and Rich and so on. The person signs into the TechNet by giving...
Repeater, time out.
A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. This is what a typical sign-in would sound like. I can't do it with the right accent, but you know what I mean. N2 and NU, Alex, and yes. That's the way a sign-in would sound. Do we have any check-in tonight? Is there anybody listening to the TechNet that's not associated with the... not completely glued to the screen because of the Super Bowl? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2LIW, listen.
Whiskey. N2EO, Dick. I have a question. Mel will be on frequency.
Okay, we had a triple. I heard Rich for sure. And I think I also heard W2... Why can I... who was the other person?
Whiskey 2, Echo Whiskey Kilo, Eugene.
Okay, we got Eugene. We've got Rich. Anyone else to check? We got Alex. Anyone else to check in?
N2RSO, Frank. No questions. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, Frank with a no. I wonder if we've got Paul yet, WS2N. I know we've got N2ASS, who might be checking in later. Let's see if we've got Mel. Mel, how are you doing tonight?
Fine business. Beautiful day today, so doing great.
Mel's the guy who ordered this weather that you're having, so thank him. It's the people in Manhattan Beach that really appreciate good weather, particularly on Super Bowl Sunday. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes. WHROYY, Joe, no questions. Fives.
Okay, we got Steve with a yes. Joe with a temporary no. You wait and see. He's going to have a question. Just wait until we really get rolling. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check in who's got a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. The very first person with a question. First of all, Alex, should we put you down for a question? Or yes or no? N2NNU, K2LIW.
No, but I would like to express my thanks for the last session that was quite animated. I was not able to do that at the time because I had to rip away from the radio.
Okay. And I checked in for you, but I can't do it with the right accent. I'm going to have to have a little more practice required. But I'll be listening and see if I can pick up the accent. Rich, and to EO, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the second half.
Okay, fine, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, N2EO, say good evening to everybody. I want to address to Mel, K2KEY. Mel, I wonder if you've had any experience with the Collins K2 KWM1 transceiver. It's something that's been gnawing away at me for a while, and I found a good one on a website, very low usage, close to new condition. I purchased it today with the 516F1 power supply. I just wanted to get, maybe you give me some history. I believe the radio probably came out around 1952, 1953. Give me a roger on that. I know most of the Collins stuff was actually commercial equipment that they made amateur versions of. I believe KWM1 probably was a commercial radio, and I say this because on the left side there's a plug-in module. They call it a CT3 that holds the crystals for the various bands in the upper left corner of the radio. And I'm assuming they had a commercial CT3 because I don't know how many know the story, but back in 1958, it was a gentleman by the name of Gary Powers who flew a U-2 spy plane taking pictures over the Soviet Union. He was shot down, and at that time, President Eisenhower denied the fact that this ever took place until the Russians paraded him in front of cameras. But my understanding is that Gary Powers had a KWM1 mounted in his U-2 spy plane. I wonder, do you own a KWM1 now? Have you used one? How do you compare it to KWM2? Give me whatever information you can. K2, KEY, and the group, and 2EO.
Okay, good evening all again. This is K2KEY. Well, quite a story about the KWM1. Where did it come from? Collins originally had, no plans actually to build the KWM1. It came about because one of the employees of Collins, one of their technicians, not an engineer, he was actually a technician, had purchased a 75A4 receiver, being that he got a so-called discount on it to somewhat when, oh no, well actually he didn't purchase, he built the 75A4. Let me get it right, he built the 75A4. Collins would sell you parts if you were an employee. I forgot how much a week. They wouldn't let you buy it all. They would let you buy it by the piece. Some craziness like that. And bit by bit, he managed to put the A4 together. He bought the panel, then he bought knobs, and then he bought a chassis, you know, and on and on and on, and had a lot of parts, resistance, capacitor, of course, of his own sockets. Maybe he had his own tubes, things like that. But he needed a number of parts that, of course, weren't easily available. Let me let it drop. What happened then, after he got the A4 together and working, being that he put it together step by step, he knew every nitty-gritty of it, he decided he'd like to have a companion transmitter. Well, he said, gee, the A4 contains a lot of things like that, PTO and a number of processing circuits, the filters and everything. Hey, why can't I just make a transmitter? In other words, turn the A4 basically into a transceiver. And when he did that, he wound up with a version, bigger version, and more of a, you know, latched-up version, and he invited Arthur Collins to his home QTH to demonstrate this thing. And Arthur Collins was enthralled. He says, wow, a transceiver. Wow. And the A4 is the, basically, it's a transmitter for the A4, because the only one previous to that they were advertising was the KWS1 as the gold twin. That was really a combination for the A4. So here we are now with this. So he turned over the whole business there to this gentleman, I'm trying to remember his name, to go ahead and to produce the KWM1. That's how it began, Rich, over.
Okay, now, I wonder, then from what you're saying, does the KWM1 receiver have a lot of the characteristics of the 75A4? And do you know the year it was first came out? It probably went out of production, I'm going to say, in 58. Because 58 is when they came out with the M2.
True. The KWM1 started in the early 50s, I believe, because I remember there was an article written by the same gentleman about, called The Rig I Built. My first sideband that I built, really, was a transceiver, basically. It was a single sideband for 80 meters. It was just an 80-meter transmitter receiver, a transceiver for single sideband. I built that also around the same time. He had a nice article on that, very straightforward. Now, as far as what years were they produced, yeah, I think starting in the early 50s and went right up into the late 50s, until they came up with the M2. I'm trying to remember, you know. I briefly had a KWM1, only briefly. It was really in passing. It really wasn't mine. It was given to me. I repaired it, and then I used it for a while, but that was really the only experience I had with it. But I remember, yes, I know I have a whole chart somewhere about all the different crystals somewhere. I remember that whole chart about the different crystals for the, you know, use on the military bands. And yes, Gary Powers aboard that U-2 did have a KWM-1. And that's how the Russians got a hold of the first transceiver, Rich, over.
K2JJ with info.
Go right ahead, Doug.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. KWM-1 was announced in April of 1957. Deliveries began in September of the same year. And it wasn't very popular. A lot of guys complained that it was only a 14 to 30 megahertz. It didn't cover 40 or 80. 10 crystals, 100 KC segments of the band. You chose them anywhere from 14 to 30 megs. But the dates were deliveries began in September 1957.
Did you ever own one, Doug, or do you know somebody who did?
No, I never did. I've got the M2s, but never came across KWM1.
And you just happened to be so interested that you collected this information. Any idea where you got that information from, Doug?
Yeah, I'm cheating here, Dick. I have a handy little book here called The Pocket Guide to Collins Amateur Radio Equipment.
Fantastic. Hey, Rich, do you have a copy of that book? And does the K6, who's a real aficionado, does he have one? Over to you, Rich.
Okay, I was going to ask Doug. Doug, where did you get that book?
The CCA, Rich. Jay Miller put it out. KK5IM, Kilo Kilo 5, Indian Mike. Jay Miller. I believe they're still available. It's called The Pocket Guide to Collins Amateur Radio Equipment, 1946 to 1980.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm going to have to check that out and see if it's still in print. That's very, very interesting. I'm surprised that the KWM-1 came out in 57, because my understanding is the M2 came out a year later in 58.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, Rich. It didn't sell well. Guys just for some reason didn't like the limited band capability, and they didn't make very many of them. I don't have exact numbers, but not very many. And then Art didn't like the way it was selling and said, go back to the drawing board, guys, and give me something that covers 10 through 80.
It's very interesting. I didn't think they made many, because this is serial number 154 or 157 that I'm getting, and the 516F1 is serial number 37. I guess they made less than 500, Doug?
Yeah, that would be in the ballpark, Rich. I don't even think they made that many, but yeah, 500 would be a number. The price also had something to do with it, Rich. If you think of 1957 dollars, The price of that radio was $770. That doesn't count the power supply. A good chunk of change back then.
Yeah, that I was aware of, 770, and I think the supply was, what, 125?
Yeah, that would be right in that range, depending whether you wanted the mobile supply or the 516F1, which was the 120-volt supply. But, yeah, a pair of 6146s, you know, the standard 100-watt CW SSD. So there you go. Anyway, back to that K2JJ.
Very fine. Awful glad you had that information for us, Doug. Rich, any further questions? And how soon do you think you're going to take delivery of your KWM1?
Hey, Doug, well, thank you very much. It should be here the end of the week. Should be here by Friday, and I'll give you guys a report. It's supposed to be in very, very clean shape, so we'll see what the story is. But I'm surprised that it came out in 67. It was a brand new piece of equipment then when Gary Powers flew it on the U2. I thought it came out earlier than that, but I guess not. Dick, thank you very much. And I'm going to check out that pocket guide to Collins radio equipment by KK5M. Back to that and to Leo.
It's KK5 India Mike, Rich. Just look up his call, Jay Miller.
Okay, Doug, I got it. KK5 India Mike. I will check that out. Back to you, Dick. Thank you, K2RIW, TechNet Y-Mark, and Julio.
Yeah, this is K2KY. One more comment.
Go ahead, Mel.
Rich, take a look at the Collins Collectors Net and see what they have on the KWM1. Doug, I was curious, did they tell you the gentleman who designed the KWM1? I can't think of his name. I'd have to look through the literature here and everything. I know I had a lot more on the KWM1. I have quite a story on it, but I can't recall his name. Did I mention it, Doug, by any chance? Over.
No, not specifically, Mel. No names, but I think maybe Warren Bruni had something to do with the design. I'm not sure, though.
Okay, very good. I guess you got interested also, Doug and Collins. Did you ever get your, I think you were working on the KWS-1. Did you ever get that on the air? Over.
Well, I've got the blower out of it, Mel. It needs a little bit of a rebuild there. The bearings are kind of dried up and shot, but I really can't do much else with it till I get some air on those finals, you know. So that's as far as I've gotten. It's one of those round to it projects.
Okay, as far as the bearings, I know that's a problem. Here's what you do. You can drill a very, very fine hole with a fine drill into the bearing housing and inject it with oil. I've done that, and it quiets it down for a long time, Doug. Over.
Yeah, it's pretty hard steel, Mel. Yeah, I'm just going to pull them and replace them. You know, they're still available. It's a standard bearing. It's kind of far down on the list of priorities, but otherwise it's very clean, and looking forward to getting it on the air. So that's another project.
Good luck with it.
Mel, when you drilled a hole into the bearing, I'm pretty sure you didn't drill a hole into the race, or maybe it's got a rubber seal that you drilled a hole through the side of, and then injected oil with an eyedropper or something like that. Give us a couple words as to how you did that one. Go ahead. That was for you, Mel. Okay, maybe Mel got called away, and we'll get to him later. Eugene, I think, is the next person on the list, W2EWK. If you got a question, Eugene, go right ahead. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. W2EWK. Well, anyway, I went to my car, and I couldn't get no signal on my satellite dish in the middle of my car. So I looked very carefully. I noticed that the wire was broken. So I took the wire, and I soldered it. you know, the heart to heart and ground to ground. I'm hoping tomorrow that works, so I'm going to give it a try tomorrow. Hopefully, it'll be working. But I can't get into the satellite dish because everything was all grooved together with such type of glue I couldn't get it off, you know, right where the wire goes inside the antenna. So I did the next best thing. I started on outside of the antenna. So you think I'm in good shape? Otherwise, I have to buy a new antenna for my satellite receiver, QSL W2EWK, for listen for your comment.
Yeah, I've got a couple of questions here. When it comes to satellite receiver, are you talking about Sirius and XM, I think it's called, or are you really talking about direct television satellite reception? Which kind of satellite reception are you talking about? Is it a sound system or a video system? I'm going to guess it's a sound system. And the wires that you soldered, are they part of a steering network, or is it actually the transmission line itself? Over to you, Eugene.
Okay, Dick. It's Sirius. It's Sirius. That's the name of the company. And it was the same as the coax cable is going into the antenna. You got the heart and you got the ground, you know. And so anyway, I saw it, the ground to ground, the heart to heart, and I kept it separate. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed to see if it works tomorrow. If it works, fine. If not, I just have to go down to the store and buy a new antenna. And like I said, it is grooved together. You cannot get it apart. Everything's all, you know, how can I say? It is, you know, molded, you know. You can break the mold, but I don't know if it's going to work anymore. QSL?
Yeah, I think I understand. I wonder what happened to the coax cable that it broke off at the end of the mold. I guess it's fatigue failure, waving in the wind when you've got this, is the antenna a mag mount on the outside of the car and the cable coming from it was being flexed and eventually broke away. Is that what happened? And when you solder the center conductor in the shield of a coax cable, as long as you've got, you know, real small dimensions, and I think the satellite system works at roughly 2 gigahertz, as long as the dimensions are nice and small, I think you should have no problem. And I'm not sure whether or not there's a preamplifier built into the Sirius antenna. So was it coax that broke away, and that's what you're resoldering back, Eugene? Back to you, Eugene, K2LIW.
Yes, W2EWK. It's a magnet that goes in the middle of my roof, and at the door, that's where it snapped in two, so I couldn't figure out how come I was not picking up the signal. So I looked at it very carefully. I said, oh boy, not quite, oh boy, but, you know, I'm talking about, and that's where it broke. So tomorrow I'll find out if it works or not. But if not, it's only like maybe $20 bill, maybe 25 tops. I'll get a brand new antenna, QSL, W2EWK.
Yeah, I think it's a good chance that what you did is going to work, as long as you made the dimensions kind of small, didn't have any whiskers that go between center conductor and shield to create a short circuit. There may be a preamplifier built into it, and once you've got the cable reconnected, you should be back in service. And so next week, I guess we're going to hear from you. Or you could run out there tonight and find out if it's working. Eugene, go ahead.
No, that's not quite okay, Dick. I'm going to walk my dog. I got a new dog. My dog died. Oh, about a month ago, I had a pug, a loving pug, and he was a good sweetheart, and he was a loving dog, and when he had cancer, so I took him to the dog pound. It cost me only $30, you know, put him down. So after that, I went to Puppy Depot, and I picked up a new one. I should say my mother picked up the new dog. I picked up the dog. They won $3,000 for it. And after $3,000, I picked out another one. They won $2,000 for it. Then my mother picked out one, and she won $350 for the dog. Guess what happened? I said, sold. and I took that $350 norm back home. It's a small chihuahua, a very, very tiny chihuahua. His name is Oscar, and so he has a very loud bark. He's a very loving dog. Okay, back to you, Dick, W2EWK.
Very fine, Eugene. Good luck with Oscar. And just like you, I'm a little bit surprised to find out what the price of dogs are these days, but you're probably talking about pedigree animals, and I guess they always were kind of expensive. Well, the next person who signed in with a real question, I think, was Steve. Yep, looks like it's Steve. KC2MDP, what would you like to talk about tonight? And how come you're not watching the Super Bowl, Steve? KC2MDP, K2LIW.
Good evening to you, Dick. Good evening to everybody else out on that. The reason I'm not watching Super Bowl is, to tell you the truth, I'm really not into it. I'm more into ham radio and electronics than I am football. Dick, I was goofing around with a microwave oven, you know. I just basically ripped this thing apart just to see what makes it tick. You know, and I went into a little magnetron and everything in there, and I guess, you know, trying to explain that magnetron, I guess it's that little tube inside that's got fins on it, and I guess the reason they call it a magnetron is because it actually has magnets in it, much to my surprise. My question is, what are those magnets actually doing, that thing? Back to you, Dick.
Boy, if you check on any of the books that talk about World War II radars, where the magnetron was developed, and I think it was primarily a British development, it's when you look at the tube schematically, it looks like it's a diode. By that I mean most magnetrons have a center cylindrical cathode, which gets heated. It's got a outer ring assembly with a whole bunch of notches in that ring. Those are the resonators, which is the plate. And in between, most magnetrons have nothing else. There's no grid. It looks like a diode. And so it is the thermionic emission equivalent of a gun diode. It presents a negative impedance, which makes it oscillate. And why does it present a negative impedance? It's because of the very strong magnet. The very strong magnet is parallel to the cylindrical center cathode. So if the tube was laid out on the table as flat as you could lay it out, where there's a center ring on the outside and the cylindrical cathode in the center, the magnetic field would be into and out of the table. When you put approximately 10,000 volts negative voltage on the cathode, and the outer ring, the resonator, is grounded, and that's going to be your output connector. There's a loop in one of those notched areas, which is the output coupling loop. So by comparison, the cathode and anode, cathode and plate, are 10,000 volts apart approximately, but rather than putting plus 10,000 on the plate, instead they put negative 10,000 on the cathode, and the filament transformer that feeds that cathode has to stand off that 10,000 volts, so it's a high voltage winding, that filament winding. And by doing it that way, the outer circuit, the part that you touch, is grounded, and it makes it B-plus-wise quite safe. The electrons leave that cathode. Under ordinary circumstances, they would go straight from the cathode to that outer ring, and it would be a simple diode, and you'd get no oscillation. Because you've got this very strong magnetic field at right angles to the
repeater, time out.
The diodes, the electrons want to leave the cathode, and in a radial manner, they want to go straight to the anode. But you've got this very strong magnetic field at right angles to their path. And by the right-hand rule, where you have your thumb up and your index finger out and your middle finger at right angles to the two of those, that gives you the velocity, magnetic field, and force. They all are at right angles to each other. The bottom line is that the electrons don't get a chance to go straight from the cathode to the anode. The magnetic field is so strong, it curves their path. It curves them in a circumferential manner. They try to run around the circle, so to speak. Well, when you get the magnetic field just right and the voltage just right, The electrons hit those outer notched areas. You probably can't see those notches until you really cut into the tube, but the outer area has got a whole bunch of resonators around that perimeter, a bunch of notches and a bunch of holes going beyond the notches, which represent a resonator at, in your case, 2450 megacycles. That's the frequency that a microwave oven operates at, 2.45 gigahertz. Those electrons get curved into a circumferential path, and on one half cycle, they hit all of the odd notches, and the other half cycle, they hit all of the even notches, and they alternate back and forth, and that's not the whole explanation, but that's a partial explanation as to why it oscillates so nicely. The tube itself is capable of extremely high efficiency, numbers like 70 or 80% of the total DC voltage and current, the total power you put into the tube, something like 70 or 80% of it is converted into RF energy that comes out of that probe that feeds the cavity that's got your food that you want to cook. A good microwave oven puts out something like 700 watts or 1200 watts of power into the chamber. The chamber is multiple wavelengths wide, multiple wavelengths high at 2450 megacycles. So really, the 700 watts or 1000 watts of RF energy that's put out by the tube goes to that probe that's inside the chamber where your food is, and it lights up that chamber. And that chamber has a
repeater. Time out.
That chamber has a bunch of standing waves. In other words, it's got hot spots and cold spots. And your food is on a rotisserie that rotates it. Otherwise, the hot spots would cook your food, the cold spots would not, and your food would be cooked unevenly. Every microwave oven either has a rotisserie table that rotates the food, or hidden into the ceiling of the chamber is a big blade that's called the stirrer or the perturber or whatever. You have to move those waves around so that the multiple hot spots eventually hit your food. And there's a whole art and science to defrosting, because it's the water in your food that does most of the cooking. It absorbs the microwave so efficiently, turns it into heat, and water does the job very nicely when it's in liquid form. But when water is frozen into ice, it's crystalline form, the diode motion of the individual molecules of water no longer takes place, and the heating goes down to a small percentage of what it did when the water was liquid. So defrosting frozen food is a whole art and science that we'll get into later on. So at least you have a little bit of the information. If you look up the word, if you Google the word magnetron, and if you read the RadLab series, Radiation Laboratory series of McGraw-Hill books that were done right after World War II, explaining how all these geniuses invented all these great radar techniques. Let me drop. I forget which book it is that covers the magnetron, but there's a very big story about how such a very simple-looking tube could be so efficient, making what was then very high frequencies. To generate a whole lot of power at 1, 2, and 3, and 10 gigahertz in 1944 was a very difficult thing to do until this magnetron had been invented. KC2MDP. You probably have a few more questions here, Steve. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2KY with a comment.
Let's let Mel say his words before we turn it back to you, Steve. Hey, Mel. I bet you've touched a few magnetrons in your time. You got it, Mel.
Oh, yeah, you remember my idea of going to put a user as a ham radio, but that one sort of fizzed out after we had a discussion about building a transmitter using a microwave tube, because problems of trying to convert it over. But you mentioned that stirrer up on the top that turns supposedly give equal distribution through the chamber. That stirrer turns in the opposite direction of the table, of the turntable on the bottom where you set your pot, your dish. And that was a problem. They had some problems for a while there that the turntable, for some reason, started to turn in the same direction as the stirrer. And that was a funny problem, that some of the microwaves were not working properly. What was happening, I don't know if it was a production mistake or whatever, but some genius figured out why it didn't work by some way of determining that the table was not turning in the opposite direction from the Storatec over.
Okay, my wife tonight noticed in our brand new microwave oven that when you turn it on, a good percentage of the time the turntable turns clockwise. A certain percentage of the time the turntable turns counterclockwise. At first I thought, well, it alternates on alternate times you turn it on. That's not it at all. The motor that turns the Lazy Susan is a kind of a AC synchronous motor which does not have a shading pole to it, which makes it favor one particular direction. So depending on whether that's the positive half cycle or the negative half cycle of Con Ed power or LIPA power, when you turn it on, the motor can decide to turn clockwise or counterclockwise. It's arbitrary. Now, even if the Lazy Susan turns in the same direction as the stirrer, in my opinion, that's not bad, Mel. As long as the rate that the stirrer turns and the rate that the Lazy Susan turns are not the same rate, as long as the rates are different, then you're still getting all the stirring action you want. Logically, turning in opposite direction is going to give you what looks like more thorough stirring. But I think you're also going to get pretty good stirring as long as the rates are different. But what's really funny, though, is that most microwave ovens, that motor has no favorite direction. And so I can remember at the factory, let me drop, at the factory where I work, where in the cafeteria, they've got about four or five of these microwave ovens. And I remember one day seeing a bunch of people heating their food, and all of those Lazy Susans were going clockwise. Came back a day later, and one or two of them was going counterclockwise. And I said, gee, am I crazy? Until I finally figured out what's going on. Let me send it back to you, Mel. I wonder if you knew about that. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Exactly. I did that experiment. You know, I gave it a little spin, you know, to try to get it to go the opposite direction from where it was turning. And the son of a gun did not cook the thing. Things were not getting hot the way they were. If I stopped it and gave it the other way, and a minute later, it's working better. I understand that they did something in to compensate for that, because there were a number of complaints that the microwave was not, ovens were not cooking correctly, and that's what they found, that when it turns in the opposite direction from the stirrer, that is the best cooking, the most even cooking. Why that is, I don't know, Vic, but I did the experiment. I wanted to see what happened. I put a glass of water on the edge of the Lazy Susan, and I measured the time it took to get that water hot, really hot. I then did the same thing, and I pushed the Lazy Susan to go the opposite way, and the son of a gun, it took much longer. It must have been going in the same direction then to get the water to boil, to get that water hot, Dick. I couldn't figure out what the heck is going on there, over.
Yeah, that is a bit amazing to me, Mel, because my understanding of the way the microwave oven works is that the magnetron tube is pouring something like 700 watts or 1,000 watts with its probe into the cavity region that has your food. And those microwaves bounce back and forth in there until something absorbs them. And the only thing around in your case that can absorb them is a glass of water. And water is a beautiful absorber. So even if it's spinning in the wrong direction, the only explanation I could come up with is that maybe when the standing waves are in a particular pattern, a hell of a lot of the energy is returned back to the magnetron. There's only two things in this universe that I know of that can absorb those microwaves that tube is generating. One is the food or water that's in the oven, and two, the tube itself. Under certain standing wave conditions, the RF energy can be reflected back to the tube, and the tube with its fins has to dissipate that energy. And I guess there's even the possibility that depending on your particular serial number of tube, that when it sees a particular standing wave ratio and certain phase angle of the oven itself, maybe it doesn't break into oscillation. But that would be a tube serial number specific condition in my opinion. I have seen the data sheet, let me drop, on mil-spec magnetrons. on a mil-spec magnetron, you do something that's called a load-pull test. By that I mean you put the tube into a known, let's say, 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. If that's the specification, that it has to operate correctly into a standing wave ratio as high as 3-to-1. You put the tube into a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio load that has a trombone-like device to it. And therefore, you can create a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, which happens to be a 6 dB reflection coefficient, and you can make that 6 dB reflection coefficient go all possible phase angles between 0 and 360 degrees. That's called the load-pull test, because you're really pulling some kind of a trombone-like device. And if the tube is meeting its specification, it should continue to put out specified power or more across all 0 to 360 degrees of the reflection coefficient being at least a 0.5 a reflection coefficient. And that's a tube that passes the test. Well, a mil-spec tube, you can insist on a test like that. In the case of a modern-day, a modern-day microwave oven is a real significant piece of inexpensive commercial engineering. The very first microwave ovens that were first delivered way back in the 1956 time frame were done by the Raytheon company, which eventually became the Amana division of Raytheon, I believe. And I think the very first microwave ovens were about as big as a refrigerator. Most of that was the power supply. Some of that was the actual tube itself. And I think they sold for numbers like $1,500 or $2,000 in 1956 dollars. Very expensive. Yeah, somebody who's running a factory that's baking bread, maybe you could afford to buy one of those, or if you're running a very big restaurant. But it was not really a home consumer product because it was too large and too expensive. Nowadays, you can buy tubes that put out a hell of a lot more power, very compact assemblies, and you can buy them for numbers like $150, and occasionally a 700-watt one will go on sale for $49. You're getting an awful lot of stuff for the money. Therefore, I think it's safe to say that for that kind of price, you're not getting a tube that has been through the full mil-spec load-pull test. Therefore, I think it's possible that some of the tubes delivered might not oscillate correctly under certain phase angles of reflection. I'm going to pass it back to you, Mel, for a comment on that one. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, definitely. Because I did one more experiment. I took out the Lazy Susan, and I put up a glass of water right in the center of the microwave. And, you know, it started to get warm, but didn't really get to the point where it would boil. For some reason, it was in a spot that, like you say, it most likely was not absorbing the microwave at a certain spot. Maybe at the center is a maybe because of it's not rotating, Dick, or whatever, or maybe because it's located right directly under the center of the stirrer. But it's funny how it'll act completely different from, you know, different spots inside the chamber. I believe that's why that Lazy Susan is, you know, an integral part of it, so that, you know, that it gets the most likely more even cooking over.
Now, funny that Steve should bring up microwave oven, because just before I got on tonight, I was the guy, the microwave expert in the house, so to speak. My wife and I decided to cook some Cornish hens in our microwave oven. And one of the things that I purchased, and there's very few of these around, is a microwave oven rated thermometer, meat cooking thermometer. And according to that thermometer, you're supposed to sink it into the middle of your chicken, in our case, the Cornish hens, and it's supposed to come up to 180 degrees Fahrenheit in order to be safe temperature for chicken that you're cooking. And if I set our microwave oven on the high mode, high power output mode, things like your liver and your gizzard and whatever that you've got on the plate alongside of the chicken that you're cooking, the Cornish hens, they start exploding. So our particular microwave oven, I can't remember what brand name it is, it's got power output settings, everything from 1 to 10. And I ran the experiment of putting in a glass of water with a microwave rated thermometer in the glass of water, and I ran it for exactly 2 minutes on exactly 2 cups of water. What is that now? 16 ounces of water, I think it is. So 16 ounces of water, I ran for 2 minutes in number 9876 all the way down. I measured the temperature increase of the water. And I found out that our particular microwave oven, it has some kind of a fancy, let me drop. It's got some kind of a fancy phase shift network that generates the pulse width modulated power supply voltage that's fed to the tube. The tube is fed square waves that have either a heavy duty factor or a light duty factor. The cheaper microwave oven that we used to have, when you set it on the lower settings, what it would do is go on for 10 seconds and off for 5 seconds and stuff like that. It intermittently ran. This one runs continuously, but the real power output of the tube changes. So it's got a fancier circuit. So when you set the rating, the power output rating of the oven low enough that it tends to cook the Cornish hens more evenly, then the amount of time that it's got to run is a little bit more nebulous. And so with the microwave oven rated thermometer in the middle of the center chicken, I had to keep setting it another 10 and 15 and 20 minutes at a time at the lower power ratings until I finally brought all of the stuff there up to the right temperature. You got to cook slowly. A microwave oven is capable of overcooking things that are on the perimeter of the plate and undercooking things that are in the center. That's just the way our particular one seems to operate. I also get more even cooking of small objects if I put a folded towel on the Lazy Susan and then put the plate of the food on top of it to raise it above the floor of the oven. I seem to get more even cooking when I do that. There's a number of tricks you have to learn with your microwave oven. Once you learn the tricks, it does a very good job. It does a very rapid job of cooking food or reheating food. But it acts very differently than an ordinary oven. An ordinary oven, depending on how big the chunk of food is you're cooking, you set the oven at, say, 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and you cook for some length of time, depending on how many pounds you've got. In the microwave oven, the pounds of food and the amount of the rating that you set the dial at for power output and the number of minutes that you do the cooking is a little bit more critical because it heats in a more different manner. And I'll leave it right there. But Steve, you're learning a lot more about microwave ovens than you probably wanted to know. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I basically just pulled apart this thing to see what made it tick, and it's surprisingly, really, how simple a circuit is in there. Most of it is all the interlocking relays and everything for the door, so you don't get yourself exposed to RF, you know, if the door opens accidentally. And the other stuff's all the timing circuit, you know, for the timer and the clock and all that other stuff. Just one quick question about them, Dick. The size of the microwave oven, is there any, what's the word I'm looking for? Any, for lack of a better word, I can't even think of, like, comparison between the size of a microwave oven. You know, it seems like some of the, you know, like, most of these microwave ovens seem to be getting, like, smaller in size. I mean, theoretically, couldn't you make, like, a microwave oven, basically, let's say, the size of a regular oven with the same output magnetron? And, you know, it might just take a little bit longer to cook. Is there any specific reason that these microwaves seem to be, you know, like a maximum size or anything like that? Back to you.
Yeah, nowadays you can buy microwave ovens where the actual cooking space is as small as 7/10 of a foot, cubic foot, all the way up to, I think, 2.5 cubic feet for the ones that are hanging below a shelf. And those are the ones that are a combination of convection and microwave. I think they come up to numbers like 2.5 cubic feet. But most of them are around 1 cubic foot or a little bit lower. The inexpensive ones that go on sale tend to be 700 watts and 7/10 of a cubic foot. As you and some of those sell for numbers like $49 on sale. The slightly more exotic ones, the one that I just bought, and I can't think of the brand name of the darn thing, was something like 1.2 or 1.4 cubic feet, and I think it was rated 1,200 watts. And although the brochure didn't tell you, I can tell that it's completely variable in power output, and I've confirmed that by how fast it heats water. As you build the microwave oven larger and larger in cubic feet, the number of standing waves in there the 2.4 gigahertz is something like a 6-inch wavelength, or is it 4.5-inch? 4.5-inch wavelength. It's a 4.5-inch wavelength, and so every half wavelength, you're going to get a standing wave. So in other words, every 2.5 inches of oven dimension, you can go through a complete peak and valley of the RF energy across that dimension of the oven. So you rapidly see that when you're taking something like a 1.2 cubic foot oven, which I think are numbers like 18 inches wide, 18 inches deep, and something like 12 inches high, you have a number of standing waves in the X dimension, the Y dimension, and the Z dimension. So there's a very complicated pattern in there, which by way of the stirrer and the lazy Susan, hopefully all those hot spots will hit your food. Well, if you're a little bit unlucky with the way you mount your food and the way it spins on that lazy Susan, it could be that you have a possibility that a certain portion of it doesn't cook as fast. However, if you set it onto a low enough reading, let me drop, a low enough power output setting, and a long enough period of time, what looks like a microwave oven starts acting a little bit more like a convection oven. Even though the center of your particular chicken, in my case, doesn't get hot as fast as you like it to, and only the perimeter of the chicken is getting hot, if I've got the power rating low enough and the time long enough, the part that gets hot will automatically, by conduction, conduct its heat to the part that isn't being heated as well, and you'll get even more even cooking. So the bottom line of all that is I've discovered that if you go for the quickest possible cooking, the highest possible setting for a relatively short period of time, you're pushing things in the direction of getting a little bit less even cooking, in my opinion. One other nasty thing about a microwave oven is that it will not brown the surface. Your regular convection oven, 350-degree air is hitting your food that you're cooking, and you want the center of the food, in the case of Cornish hens, to come up to 180 degrees. So the surface is being heated a hell of a lot faster than the center, and therefore you get a little bit of charring on the surface that you and I call browning, and we like that. And you don't get browning on a microwave oven because although it may heat the outer perimeter portion of your chicken more rapidly, it is heating a couple of centimeters deep, whereas the hot air out of your convection oven is really touching just the outer skin of the chicken and charring it and giving it that browning. You don't get a browning action out of a microwave oven. But there are people who study carcinogenicity of food, and they think it's better that you don't brown or char the outer portion of your food. But there are people who think it's safer if you don't do that. Anybody with any further comments on microwave ovens, give me your call letters right now, K2RID.